Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're really lucky to have with us again, I think for the third time, back all the way back to 2011, Chris Cleave, author of Little Bee, Incendiary, and Gold, all of which we've talked about in our last chats. Today, we'll be talking about his brand new novel, Everyone Brave is Forgiven, which Simon & Schuster will publish tomorrow. Incidentally, on the same day that Chris will be speaking once again at the Free Library of Philadelphia. The last time he appeared there, and we've talked about this before the show, I was amazed and delighted that Vice President Biden's wife stopped her plane, basically turned it around, because she taught Little B to her kids, loved Chris, her students. Then somehow I buttonholed her, and my daughter and I chatted with her for almost 20 minutes, just us. Then she asked my daughter Annie what she liked to read, and Annie said she didn't like books that much, and I was mortified. But I digress, as I often do. So today, Everyone Brave is Forgiven. Once again, one of those books that transcends, that leaves you exhausted, wanting more, and overcome with emotion. Jeez, it sounds like I'm talking about sex. And in a roundabout way, I am. Chris is very discreet. The book is surrounded by love, all kinds. And it's this love, plus tragedy, plus humor on each and every page, that gives this book a something that I can't really articulate. It's a book about the war, the only war that really still resonates with those of us who are of a certain age, not the millennials, not the Xers, not those who fought in it, as they are gone or almost gone. But with the baby boomers and those who lived just years from it, I was born 7 years after it ended, so that would be as if the war occurred for me in 2009 now, that many years. And my father was a captain in the Army. But unlike the Yanks' version of the war, Everyone Brave tells the story of those on the outer edges of the war in Great Britain, for the most part, but also tells the tale of those who were immersed in the dirt, filth, horror of war, who took in the death, the unspeakable sights, the loss, and received in return the physical and emotional wounds that would live with them for the rest of their days. But as to the love I spoke of, whether it's between Mary Vine and Lydia, or Mary and Tom, or Mary and Alistair, or Tom and Alistair, or Mary and her mother, or Mary and Palmer, especially when he brings the silver tray, or Mary and Zachary, the damn thing is full of love. So the real question of the book, and eventually it's framed perfectly, is one, whether love is real, two, whether it's enough, and three, whether it will last. And are we courageous enough, I guess, to decide really without enough information? So before I conduct this interview with myself, welcome, Chris, and thanks so much for coming back to talk with me.
Oh, hello again, Sam. Thanks very much for having me on again. It's a real pleasure to be back.
Yeah, likewise. So, you know, so go ahead, before I monopolize the conversation, as you know I do, tell us about the book, and especially also, to preface it, about your opening letter to the readers.
Well, first of all, I love your characterization of the book. It is a book about love, and something I discovered when you're writing a story set in a global war is that you don't necessarily need a bad person in it. You know, a war novel doesn't need a bad guy because the war itself is evil. Death itself is the antagonist of the good characters. And so I was able to write a story where everyone is good, where everyone screws up despite that, where everyone's flaws are tested by the extremity of the situation they're in. And where we do ask these questions, so, you know, what is love and what does it really mean to put someone else before yourself at a time when the whole world is sacrificing in that way? That's what the story is about. It's about how brave it is to fall in love in a world that's falling to bits.
And talk a little bit about how your grandfather and both of your grandfathers figured into the beginning of this book that was something, and then including Churchill, and then turned into something else completely. And
yeah, well, this is how the book started for me. So my maternal grandfather, David Hill, your father, was a captain during the war, and he was stationed in Malta. So Malta was the only British possession at that time in the Mediterranean. So 1,000 miles to the east, you had the strategic port of Alexandria. 1,000 miles to the west, you had another strategic port, which is Gibraltar. but Malta was the only thing in between, and if Britain could hold on to that, then it could stop the Axis powers of Germany and Italy from supplying their armies in North Africa, which was the biggest fight in town at that time. So Malta was incredibly strategically important. It's a tiny island, probably about the size of London, and it was so viciously contested that it became the most heavily bombed place on Earth before or since. And my grandfather was stuck there. The island was besieged. He was stuck there for 3 years. And I got talking with him about it towards the end of his life. He asked me to type up a memoir that he was working on. I began that out of a sense of duty. But after about 10 pages, I was completely hooked and realized that behind this funny and mild-mannered man, there was a history of absolute steel. He'd been through a hell of a lot in the war, and he'd had some amazing responsibilities. So one of the missions he had, which you alluded to, was that he was put in charge of the safety of the Prime Minister's son. So a Prime Minister at the time, Winston Churchill, had a son called Randolph. And Randolph was brilliant, but he was also psychologically very highly strung and a little bit reckless. And my grandfather was given the job of being his attaché, and he was given the order to make sure that the man didn't get into any sort of trouble, which was a very ambiguous order, actually, because at that point it seemed that an invasion of the island by the Germans was imminent. And my grandfather spent a lot of time wondering what this order meant, because there's only so much protection that he could do of this man, who was really quite reckless and prone to, you know, running through gunfire for fun. And he began to wonder whether it meant that under no circumstances should Randolph Churchill be captured by the enemy, because he would make such a valuable hostage. So the power dynamic between the two men was very interesting, and that's what I started out exploring. But then I found a whole box of letters between my grandfather and my grandmother. So she was just as interesting as he was. She was fiercely independent, very principled, and extremely bright, and she was called Mary, and she was a school teacher. So she taught children in London and in the surrounding counties during the period that we in the UK called the Blitz, which was the period from 1940 and 1941, where London was extremely heavily bombed by Germany for about 260 days and nights. And the separation between my grandparents, who were not yet married, occurred quite early on in their relationship. So they fell more and more in love in these letters. And I was able to read these wartime letters between them and realized that my grandmother, as well as my grandfather, was an incredible person. So I started to become fascinated by their story and to realize that, you know, as a family, I had roots. There was a place that I came from, which I've never really paused to consider before. And I wanted to find out more about them. And they became the gateway, really, to some really intensive research into that incredible period of the war in between 1939, where it began for Britain, and 1942, where America came into the war and basically bailed us out. And saved us, because there's no doubt that without America's intervention, Britain would have eventually fallen. And so it tells the story of that part of the war after the start of hostilities, but essentially before Pearl Harbor, in which the fate of Britain and the fate of the relationships of these two main characters is in the balance.
And what you did, and I think what you do in all your books, in addition to the book work, which I know you do, you actually went to Malta, you talked to people who still remember, and you also put yourself on the rations of both the people in Britain and the soldiers on Malta.
Yeah, and that's my deal with readers. I make a point of honor that I will not write about a place unless I've been there and, you know, dug around in the soil there and talked to the people who live there and talked to the old people who have lived there for a long time. If I'm writing about characters who are on rations, you know, I'll make sure that I put myself on those rations to know what it feels like. I do a lot of research, which is almost like method acting. And I do it because it works, you know, because you don't really know the questions that you'd want to ask in your research until you've lived a life that's quite similar to that which your characters would be living. You know, to give an example, when I did spend a lot of time on Malta, I spent a lot of time in the military cemeteries. And, you know, you'll have visited some of these places, and a lot of the listeners will have too, and will be familiar with that environment of a military cemetery, how haunting it is, and how, you know, if you spend a little time there quietly, slowly, the presence of all of these people who sacrificed their lives slowly becomes more real to you. But you notice little differences. And on Malta, I noticed that there were six men buried in every grave, six names on every headstone, which is very unusual. I mean, all of the other military cemeteries I've visited in different parts of the world have one headstone per person. And so I got to wondering why, and I asked the curator of the cemetery, and he told me, well, just go and dig a hole any way you like on this island, and then you come and tell me. And so I did, you know, and I discovered that really Malta is this yellow limestone rock under just 6 inches of very poor topsoil, and it's incredibly hard to dig a hole. And that's when the reality of how awful the siege of Malta had been really struck me. You know, they were starving. They'd been blockaded for more than 2 years. They were eating cats, dogs, rats, and pigeons. Everyone was emaciated. Everyone was weak. And they simply didn't have enough strength to dig a hole for everyone who had died. And so they had to dig one hole and make it suffice for six people. And it was in that little detail that you know, these are the things that you don't really discover unless you actually go to the places and puzzle them out. You don't realize the extent to which people were hungry and the extent to which that hunger sapped people's strength and their morale. And so it's from that I said, right, yes, okay, so the next thing I need to do is to put myself on wartime rations and see what hunger feels like. And so for the first time in my life, I was really hungry for a sustained period. And I found that wasn't at all the way I'd expected it either. Now, you go through a few days where you're incredibly demotivated, where any petty grievances you have seem really accentuated. And then you go through this other, you know, a very strange period after a couple of weeks where you start feeling quite spaced out. And you see the world in a different way. You see things, some things more clearly and some things more hazily. They had these incredible effects, and all of that poured itself into the novel in what I hope is the kind of realism that you get when you really sort of live through the research rather than just, you know, invent some questions and Google them. And that's my contract really with the reader, is I will do all of this so that they don't have to. I'll do all this so that the book has a kind of authenticity to it. Whatever period I'm writing in, whether it's contemporary or whether it's historic, I really do want to go there and live through it to the extent to which that's possible. And then not to put everything down on the page that I discovered, but just to let it be implicit.
You know, it's funny. There's lots of things that seem to kickstart you. You just described one. The other one was, you know, when you've said that you really understood what was going on with little B when she made you laugh for the first time. It was the same thing when you said, well, I don't know who's saying these things to me. You know, it's transcendent. There's these voices and I'm writing it down, but I don't actually know who they are. And I thought of that when I was reading this book because, yes, little B made me laugh and little B was funny in a lot of ways, notwithstanding the fact that in all your books, in many novels, but in yours specifically, you know, you have these ordinary people that find themselves in extraordinary situations, especially Mary, who's only 18, and you keep forgetting she's only 18. But so just to go through a couple of them. So I'm laughing out loud, and I don't know whether you do too, but and I don't know whether this is all classic stiff upper lip British ethos or whether it's kind of a stand-up routine for everybody, but like, for example, with Duggan, Duggan and Alistair are in a horrible situation because of the one bad guy in the book, the Sergeant Major, because Colonel Hamilton isn't bad. He's just British. Mm-hmm. So they're in a horrible situation, yet as they wander through the night without compasses and without their lights, Alistair says to him, "Are you all right?" He says, "As an actor, I'm tremendous." And then he says he could have had the Sergeant Major barred from every club in Soho. And, you know, he could be dying. And then he said he was tempted to die just to spite the Sergeant Major, that he has biscuits at home, but he never said he would share them. And then they talk about boots. And my favorite, of course, is, which was kind of corny, is when Alistair says, "Miss London?" And he goes, "I didn't get through the bathing suit round." So were you laughing?
I like that one.
I love that one. Were you laughing out loud when you wrote it?
Yeah, I laughed through all of the dialogue. I know people who are soldiers and former soldiers, and they're some of the funniest people I've ever met. And I refuse to pretend that that soldiers are very serious all the time, and I really believe in the way that they use humor to win. You know, I think that morale is the core of what makes a nation great, what makes an army great, what makes a home front great, what makes a city great. You know, life is really, really hard in war and in peace. And it's the people that can find something to laugh about that can hang together. And so I actually think that when soldiers are laughing and joking around, or when the civilians in the novel are exchanging, you know, quips and banter, they're not mucking about. They're winning the war.
I agree.
That's what they're doing.
But it's funny, though, because it's not just... you know, Simonson and Alistair joking about the jam, or Duggan, or any of the other soldiers. But you know, Mary and Lydia, or Mary. Well, Tom's kind of like, you know, poor Tom. But so I'd leave him out. But or Mary and Alistair, or Tom and Alistair, or Mary and her mother, or Mary and Palmer. When Palmer says, "I shall make a note." I mean, that's really funny, and it is humor, but it's very different than American humor. And when Scott went to Antarctica and he and all of his fellows died, Lawrence Oates was one of the people that went with him, and
yes.
And you know, he got frostbite horribly in all of his extremities, and he was slowing everyone down. So one night he just stood up and opened the door to the tent and says, I'm just going outside. I may be some time."
Great. And great one-liner, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's going out to die, but yeah. Yet he's still, and it's like, you know, it just, what does it do? It makes you feel, it fills you up with something, doesn't it? Yeah. It just kind of, you can...
With pride.
Yes.
You know, with pride for how beautiful and strong human beings are. I don't think that's necessarily a uniquely British thing either, that stiff upper lip. I do think it's universal. No. I do think that understated humor is a hallmark.
It may be the dialect, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Scott, of course, who died as well, wrote in his journal and says it was just the actions of a brave man and an English gentleman. So that's really what I, when I split
but
the two.
But the understated delivery.
Yeah.
Is great. I think one of my favorite parts in all of literature is in Cormac McCarthy. And I think it's No Country for Old Men, isn't it? Where there's some... The sheriff and his deputy are on horseback, I think, and they're riding down onto the plain to the scene of this drug bust that's gone horrifically wrong. And there are lots of fly-blown corpses laying out on the sand. And it's, you know, all of the buyers and all of the sellers have basically panicked and shot each other up. So there are bales of cocaine and briefcases of money lying all over the place and lots of bodies, just tons of bodies. And the sheriff and his deputy ride slowly around the scene, surveying and cataloguing in more or less silence. And at the end, the deputy turns to the sheriff, takes the toothpick out of his mouth and says, "Sheriff, it looks like trouble." And then the sheriff turns around to him and says, "Well, if it ain't trouble, it'll do till trouble gets here."
I remember it very well, and it reminded me of the scene in Kill Bill, where they have the wedding massacre, and the sheriff goes in and almost does the same thing. He kind of taps one of the dead bodies with his toe and has his toothpick in his mouth, too. It was very similar.
It's good. It's that sort of laconic delivery that's a real winner.
That is kind of American, that.
Yeah.
It's different.
I love it, and I think it comes from the same source of strength, which is to say, look, death is frightening, death is scary, but there's exactly one way in which we can be stronger than it, and that's by being funny.
There's a really good film studies thesis for a doctoral thesis, the difference in gallows humor between British and American films.
that would be amazing. That would be really good. I'm in. How long could it take?
Well, the funny thing is I literally have written down all these funny things from each page. It's silly for the listener here to hear me say them, but I mean, I don't know how you're able, other than the fact that you're right, this is what really happened, to be able to infuse so much humor and so much of it like it was right out of, you know, a movie like My Girl Friday or something like that. So if I switch gears, to the love aspect of it, for example, and then I don't know how you do this, but in Mary's correspondence with Alistair, especially the first letter and the last line of the first letter where she goes, "You must let me know what you want to do about arrangements."
Mm-hmm.
If I got that letter from someone I was passionately, madly in love with, I would be in heaven because, mm-hmm. And then, you know, he writes, "Damn the garret and damn your old clothes. I wish I was there with you." And I'm thinking, send it. Send that letter. Please send the letter. And he doesn't. Yeah. But, you know, it's like I'm so emotionally entangled with this. Plus, Mary's so beautiful and mm-hmm. she's perfect. And if you have somebody that, and then their love is transmitted by the comical. You know, their letters back and forth, I have applied mothballs, although I was tempted to use something more flammable. That's saying I love you.
Yeah. They love each other, but they almost don't dare to say it, do they? And I think there's a stage of most relationships where the people involved go through that. There's a lot in the novel about how difficult it is to fall in love and how brave you have to be. You know, to essentially put your cards down on the table and say, "Well, that's me. That's my hand."
And then also, when their relationship somewhat changes, they both apologize for not professing that love at the outset. And the other thing that's amazing that you did, and this is where I was going to tell my story, is how can you fall in love with somebody's back? You know, but you can. And what happened with me was, I was in an airport, and I passed this I was obviously much younger, and I passed this woman who was beautiful, and we made eye contact, and we just looked at each other, and we both knew. And then we just passed each other. She walked maybe 10 meters. I walked 10 meters. We both turned around and looked again, and then we just kept walking to our respective locations. And I knew, she knew, but I don't know how. But, you know, that's what I'm talking about with, you know, falling in love with someone's back, you know, because Lydia said...
I have to ask, what happened?
Nothing. I never saw her again. It was just, we both knew at that moment. It just wasn't, it was like that movie Sliding Doors.
That's amazing.
I know.
That's haunting.
I know. And I try to live life without regrets, and I don't regret that. It was, the moment was sublime, but... But it was just, you know, what if, you know, it was a what if. And, but that happened all the time in the war. And the interesting thing about the war with love, and I think you mentioned it, is, you know, time is just so compressed because it has to be.
Yeah.
So
I think people lived, and this is something that I heard from so many of the people that I interviewed. And this is interesting because I think, you know, these are the last years in which it's going to be possible to have primary sources for a novel like this. You know, because the people that I was able to speak with are in their 90s now, and so it's now and for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years maybe that we can go and talk to them. And they talked about how different life was compared to the way they see their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren starting relationships, and they had, you know, every day could be their last. They didn't have this high frequency, low intensity, reassuring communication that we have. You know, you couldn't email or text people 20 times a day. You had to write them a letter once a week and pour your whole self into it.
And hope that it got there.
Yeah, hope that it got there. Really commit to people on the strength of nothing other than a sort of almost universal faith in humans, more than a specific faith in that person.
Well, look at Mary's first letter that doesn't get there.
Yeah.
And now it changes her life for a while.
Yeah. There's a kind of, there's a beauty in it, and there's also a very sort of fragile kind of faith in it. And whole lives were set in motion by a glance across a room, just exactly of the kind that you describe, and which, you know, I'm haunted by that, and it didn't even happen to me. you sometimes get that sense of connection with someone, though. You know, I'm very happily married, and which, you know, I've been really lucky. But now, the context in which I notice that, more as a novelist than anything, is that sometimes you have a connection with someone and you just think, yeah, in a different life, in another universe, you know, you and I would, you know, would have that connection.
Well,
and
it's
that's
like
this real sort of subtle, unspoken thing, isn't it, between two people sometimes?
Yes, and marriage, since I've been through two of them, is much like Mary's mother says when Mary asks her about the passion between she and her father. And, you know, she says the passion becomes light. And you wonder, I can understand that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously,
yeah.
You wrote it, so you know what I mean.
Mm.
But, and then one of the most poignant moments is when Palmer comes in. Palmer's so cool. When Palmer comes in with the silver tray.
That's probably my favorite moment. Because here you have this servitor, this kind but deliberately self-effacing man, who's nevertheless, you know, there for Mary much more than her parents are, and you realize that he's the only character that has quietly watched her grow up. And as you say, she's 18 at the beginning of the novel, 21 by the end, but in those 3 years, she has turned from being a very naive and precocious debutante to having lived, you know, 1,000 lives, as everyone did in those wartime years. You know, they came out of it being physically young, but emotionally old. And so you have this scene which I found quite moving between Mary, who has grown up so much, and Palmer, the butler, who has seen her grow up since she was a baby and has noticed her coming of age. So I think that as I get older and as I learn to trust my readers more, and as I meet more of the readers out on the road, I get an idea that I can trust them to do a lot of the human imagination and a lot of the work. And it's enabled me to find this writing style that's a bit more spare and lets the characters be themselves and reveal themselves on the page without me needing to over-explain. I think in some of my earlier novels, I tended to over-explain, and I think my readers have cured me of that. You know, so we do all improve together, you know, readers and writers, and you know, they are my teachers, and this is how I learn. So hopefully, as I'm moving on, the novels have more space in them for the reader, and that's how I hope those effects come out, because the reader is allowed to discover the characters for themselves now, and that's the difference between the way I'm writing now and my earlier work.
Yeah, and the last thing I'd want to say is this is your best book, but obviously you hope to improve and you hope to get better and better, but there's something about this book that's different in that you have been able, well, you did in the other books too, but more so I feel like, as I said, or when she says like, "Oh, Palmer," or "The Silver Tray," or one line in a letter that there's no reason why I should interpret it the way I did. I know that Alistair does, but there's no reason why I should feel this welling of emotion because we need to see what arrangements need to be made. That doesn't even mean anything.
I know, isn't it great? It's just perfectly ambiguous. And so I think that something I'm more able to do now is to give the reader space to project their own experiences and their own desires onto the characters. And I've just tried to be as honest as I can about how I have felt about people in my life, and just take my courage in my hands, I think, and assume that those are universal experiences and it's not just weird stuff about me. And so I think if you put those yearnings and those desires and those compassions and those fears, those insecurities and those faults, if you pour it all into the novel and just hope that people will see themselves in it too, I think that's how I write now.
It's funny, it's almost Joycean, except for the fact that you can understand it. So, like, I was thinking of Finnegan's Wake, actually, because, without spoiling anything, because of the, the way the book runs, and the very, very end, it reminds me of Finnegan's Wake. Are you still there? Nah, it's going out again. I'm gonna call your cell phone and then.
Sure.
Well, no, now it's back.
Yeah.
I think listeners don't mind this too much if we talk about it. Okay, so how Finnegan's Wake ends with the same words it begins with: "River run past even atoms from swerve of shore to bend of bay," and it ends the same way it begins. It kind of reminded, with a little 90-degree turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a deliberate symmetry in the book, and I wanted to give the sense of an ending that's also a beginning. And Finnegan's Wake is a good example. I don't obviously deserve to be mentioned in the same breath as that novel, but
depends on who you're talking to.
I like the way all of Joyce's stuff ends. I like Ulysses.
Yeah, Molly.
On yes.
Yes.
You know, that's for me the most beautiful ending of a book.
It's one of the few things I've memorized, and of all things, me memorizing Molly Bloom's soliloquy. It just doesn't seem right.
That's fantastic, though. And it's a beautiful, beautiful ending. Books are really hard to end. I do hope that the book has some symmetry. I deliberately wanted to end it with the sense of something else beginning at the same time. I love the way that you've seen something of Finnegan's Wake in it. I mean, I don't put myself on that pedestal at all, of course. But I do like it. I like the way all of Joyce's stuff finishes. Actually, I like the way Ulysses finishes with yes. Yes is what I want a novel to end with. And they're very hard to end. I feel that I could start 10 novels a week. I love beginning things. I think human stories have these natural beginnings full of promise and excitement. And you can create a world in 3 paragraphs, and it's very exciting. And then bringing it into land and leaving the reader with a very particular feeling of sadness and hope and potential, and that they've been on a long journey, but they've come through it refreshed and ennobled as well as exhausted, you know, is a difficult thing. You know, finishing them, it takes years. Starting them takes minutes.
Yeah, and it's funny because you have so many ideas, and I've heard you talk about the fact that you have 4 novels already kind of in your head, and it's wonderful to have all those half-formed, amorphous stories boiling over, beginning to coalesce. But for the reader, like at the end of this, I'm so full of what they're full of. I won't go there, but the feelings they have are the same feelings I have, and I'm hoping for so much, and yet I don't know whether I or the characters are going to achieve it. But in any event,
thank you. That's such a kind way to describe it. If that's how you feel at the end of it, then I'm really happy. You know, I think that we are humans, and we have a particular natural frequency at which we resonate, and if a novel sort of leaves you vibrating at that frequency, then it's working.
Oh, I can give you a compliment, but it's going to give you a really swelled head, because Virginia Woolf said something like, when she's reading a book, a really good book, she can't be far away from it. And mm-hmm. So after I read this book, I've been carrying it around in my backpack, but I don't know why, because I've already read it, but it's mm-hmm. been in my backpack for a week now.
You're right. But thank you. You know, I feel that way about this book in a way that I haven't felt about my previous books.
Good.
I sort of feel that I'm carrying it around with me. And actually, I can't let it go. I'm going to write a sequel that I'm working on now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great. That's what I was hoping for, but I didn't want to ask you.
Yeah, it's the first time I've ever felt like that I don't want to let it go when it's finished. I love these characters. I think they've got legs, and I just really want to know what happens to them, and I want to know that they're going to, at some level, be all right. And the next period is so exciting, actually. You know, and as much as war brings everyone down to their nadir, that incredible period from 1945 through to maybe 1951, where the world is rebuilt out of its own ashes with this incredible energy coming out of America and this sort of exhausted acknowledgement coming out of the UK that we all will have to reinvent ourselves too. And somehow we create the modern world, you know, and that is an exciting period, and I want to put as much joy and regrowth into that,
but you have
there is destruction in the first book.
Yeah, but you have to be careful, because you have to remember what Mary's mother said when Mary said, you know, I feel like we're on the cusp of something. And she says, we could make a tapestry of cusps.
Yeah, we could. Of all the cusps we've been on, we could serve, I think she says, we could serve tea and cakes.
It's funny. I'll leave you with me talking. This is really weird. I had this girlfriend. Her name was Melanie. She was British. And one night we were just lying on a sofa, and I would put my head in her lap, and then she in mine, and we would tell stories to each other. And we told this story, and I think it was even Tom. It was about two soldiers. They both loved the same woman. One stayed at home. One went away. When the one away came back, the woman realized that this was the one she loved, and she didn't want to hurt the feelings of the other one. Isn't that strange?
Mm-hmm. it's a story. It's a universal story.
It is.
People stay. Some people go.
Yep.
And you don't know how you feel until they go.
Well, that's a good way to end. We'll end on that way. And it's, I'm sorry about the trouble we've had with our radio telephone, but I think this will come out fine, and I'll just have to work with my engineer on it.
But, I think it's fine. I blame British technology at this end. It's not what it used to be.
Nor is ours.
But it's been really nice talking with you again, Sam.
Yes.
Fantastic. I'm really hoping to catch up with you when I'm in town.
Yeah, I'll definitely be down there for the for your appearance at the library, and hopefully I'll hang around and maybe I'll try and get a word in earlier, and then maybe we can, depending on what you're doing afterwards, maybe we can chat a bit.
I'd love that.
Me too.
Thank you so much for reading the book, as ever, so incredibly closely and carefully. I mean, what you've said about it, it's incredibly insightful, and you found so much meaning in it. And for me, that's just, you've absolutely made my day and year. So
thank you. But
it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it has been. So I'll talk to you soon, or see you soon.
Great. Thanks so much, Sam. Take care in the meantime.
Okay, bye, Chris. That was Chris Cleave talking about Everyone Brave is Forgiven, his novel After Gold, Little Bee, and Incendiary. One of my favorite authors. Now I consider him a good friend, actually, and I've never met him, but it's a pleasure working with him, talking to him, and I wish to God I could write like him. So in any event, join us every week on The Avid Reader. We had some technical problems this time. We're going to try and work them out. We've got coming up NEA Literature Fellow Callan Wink. We'll discuss his latest collection of short stories, Dog Run Moon. And historian Peter Ross Range, who's going to discuss his latest book, 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. And as always, for a complete schedule, just look at our website or Podomatic or iTunes, and you'll see who's coming up and who's been, over 300 authors. So thanks again for joining us here today with Chris Cleave on The Avid Reader.